experience that as either shame or humiliation. If Sonia's self-talk is, I am a failure, that's shame. If her self-talk is, man, my boss is so out of control, I don't deserve this, that's humiliation. Humiliation feels terrible and makes for a miserable work or home environment. And if it's ongoing, it can certainly become shame if we start to buy into the messaging. It is, however, still less destructive than shame, where we internalize that failure comment. Sonia's humiliation self-talk is, this isn't about me. When we do that, it's less likely that we'll shut down, act out, or fight back. We stay aligned with our values while trying to solve the problem. Embarrassment is normally fleeting and can usually, eventually, be funny. It's by far the least serious and detrimental of these emotions. The hallmark of embarrassment is that when we do something embarrassing, we don't feel alone. We know other folks have done the same thing, and like a blush, the feeling will pass rather than define us. Getting clear on the language is an important start to understanding shame. Emotional literacy is the core of shame resilience, which means moving from shame to empathy, the real antidote to shame that we'll dig into more later in this section. How shame shows up at work. Looking for shame in organizations is like inspecting a home for termites. If you walk through a house and actually spot termites, you've got an acute problem that probably has been going on for a while. If you walk through an office or school or place of worship and you actually see shame, you see a manager berating an employee or a teacher belittling a student or clergy using shame as a control mechanism or an activist using shame as a social justice tool, you're witnessing a full-blown threat to your culture. You have to figure out how and why it's happening and deal with it immediately and without shame. What's trickier is that in most cases, shame is hidden behind the walls of organizations. It's not dormant. It's slowly eating away at innovation, trust, connection, and culture. But it's tougher to spot. Here's what to look for. Perfectionism. Favoritism, gossiping, back-channeling, comparison, self-worth tied to productivity, harassment, discrimination, power over, bullying, blaming, teasing, cover-ups. These are all behavioral cues that shame has permeated a culture. A more obvious sign is if shame has become an outright management tool. Is there evidence of people in leadership roles bullying others, criticizing subordinates in front of colleagues, delivering public reprimands, or setting up reward systems that intentionally embarrass, shame, or humiliate people? In one of our workshops, a woman leaned back into her chair with tears in her eyes and said, "Oh, my shame is so deep, I don't even know how to go there." Her colleagues listened with care as she opened up about a boss who repeatedly criticized her in front of others. Faith communities and schools are not exempt from shame. In our original research on shame, 85% of the people we interviewed could recall a school incident from their childhood that was so shaming it changed how they thought of themselves as learners. What makes this worse is that approximately half of those recollections were what I refer to as creativity scars. The research participants could point to a specific incident in which they were told or shown that they weren't good writers, artists, musicians, dancers, or something else creative. The shame tool used in these situations was almost always comparison. This helps explain why the gremlins are so powerful when it comes to creativity and innovation, and why using comparison as a management tool stifles both. On the flip side of that finding, the same data showed that more than 90% of people we interviewed could name a teacher, coach, school administrator, or faculty member who reinforced their self-worth and helped them believe in themselves and their ability. What do these seemingly competing findings tell us? School leaders have enormous power and influence, and how they use that power and influence changes people, for better or worse. I've met plenty of daring leaders who are committed to not using shame, but I've never been in a totally shame-free organization. Maybe they exist, but I'd be surprised to find one. The best case scenario is that it's a limited or contained problem rather than a cultural norm. One of the most common scenarios that came up in the research is the shame people feel when they're fired and how they're fired. Susan Mann has over 3 decades of senior leadership experience in banking, higher education, and philanthropy. Before starting her own coaching and consulting practice, Susan was the head of the Global Learning and Development Team at the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. Credentialed by the International Coach Federation, Susan is a founding member of the Daring Way Senior Faculty. The Daring Way is our training and certification program for helping professionals, offered through Daring Education, our nonprofit. Susan helps grow the leadership capacity of our company by coaching our emerging leaders. When I asked her about the very tough task of firing employees, she said this: "Early in my human resources career, one of my mentors taught me to always give people a way out with dignity. 3 decades later, after countless conversations advising leaders how to fire people, I feel like I have leaned into this advice hundreds of times." What does it mean to give someone a way out with dignity? Remember the human and pay attention to feelings. Of course, leaders must make the thoughtful business decisions that are right for the company. Lay off people, fire someone, reassign a person to a different role. Definitely do what makes sense to achieve the company's goals. And while you're doing what you need to do, always hold the human in mind. Keep that person who will be impacted by your decision squarely in front of you. This person has a family, a career, and a life that will be affected. When you're delivering the news, be kind, be clear, be respectful, be generous. Can you let the person resign rather than be fired? Can you provide severance pay? Ask the person how they want to let colleagues know about their departure and follow their lead on that if possible. Can you allow a graceful exit so they can retain their dignity? This isn't about avoiding hard decisions and hard conversations. It's about knowing that we all have hearts and can be hurt. Great leaders make tough people decisions and are tender in implementing them. That's giving people a way out with dignity. I asked Susan what gets in the way of giving people a way out with dignity. Susan replied with these answers. The first thing, armoring up. I've seen a lot of leaders get defensive when they decide to fire someone. It's a weighty decision, and I see people stay in their heads and be super rational, citing all the reasons why the decision is correct and justifiable. It's a form of self-protection. The second thing, time and money. Giving people a way out with dignity is a bigger investment of time, money, heart, and energy. It requires us to slow down, be more thoughtful, and have fuller conversations. That doesn't happen as often as it should. The third answer she gave me was the fall guy. Sometimes a person takes the hit for a broken system or team. The leader is looking, often unconsciously, for someone to blame for what's not going well, rather than looking at herself in the mirror and wondering what she could do to fix the bigger issues. The next one is lack of vulnerability and courage. An inability to hold the duality of head and heart and engage with both at the same time. I see leaders express fear about the emotion the person being fired may show. I'm afraid she's going to cry or get mad. Sometimes they're afraid that they may show emotion themselves. What if I'm so nervous I lose it? She concluded, there is an art to giving people a way out with dignity. It's a huge skill to develop, and it takes practice. Few companies and leaders make that skill a priority. Perhaps the most devastating sign of a shame infestation is a cover-up. Cover-ups are perpetrated not only by the original actors, but by a culture of complicity and shame. Sometimes individuals are complicit because staying quiet or hiding the truth benefits them and/or doesn't jeopardize their influence or power. Other times, people are complicit because it's the norm. They work in a cover-up culture that uses shame to keep people quiet. Either way, when the culture of a corporation, nonprofit, university, government, church, sports program, school, or family mandates that it's more important to protect the reputation of that system and those in power than it is to protect the basic human dignity of individuals or communities, you can be certain of the following problems. Shame is systemic. Complicity is part of the culture. Money and power trump ethics. Accountability is dead. Control and fear are management tools. And there's a trail of devastation and pain. When it comes to real talk about shame, we have to set it up the right way so people feel safe. These are powerful conversations. Giving people permission to talk about shame is liberating. It shines a light in a dark corner. People realize they're not alone. Sharing their stories together normalizes shame, creates connection, and builds trust. These are the hard conversations that can point the way to desired new behaviors and culture shifts. And in some cases, a healing conversation about shame can change our lives. Shame resilience. The bad news is that shame resistance is not possible. As long as we care about connection, the fear of disconnection will always be a powerful force in our lives, and the pain caused by shame will always be real. But here's the great news. Shame resilience is possible, teachable, and within reach for all of us. Shame resilience is the ability to practice authenticity when we experience shame, to move through the experience without sacrificing our values, and to come out on the other side of the shame experience with more courage, compassion, and connection than we had going into it. Ultimately, shame resilience is about moving from shame to empathy, the real antidote to shame. In the next section, we're going to do a deep dive into empathy and self-compassion. But for now, it's important to understand that if we share our story with someone who responds with empathy and understanding, shame can't survive. Self-compassion is also critically important. But because shame is a social concept, it happens between people. It also heals best between people. A social wound needs a social balm, and empathy is that balm. Self-compassion is key because when we're able to be gentle with ourselves in the midst of shame, we're more likely to reach out, connect, and experience empathy. Empathy. Empathy is one of the linchpins of cultures built on connection and trust. It's also an essential ingredient for teams who take risks and show up for rumbles. There are 5 elements to empathy, and we'll explore each one. Meanwhile, empathy is easily confused with sympathy, giving advice and judgment disguised as concern. To add empathy to our courage toolbox, it's important that we are able to translate it into specific skills that we can learn and practice. Readily distinguish empathy from sympathy, and understand the big barriers to empathy. Let's start with a story. A couple of years ago, Suzanne, our president and COO, and I spent the day facilitating our Daring Leadership program at Fort Bragg. It was an amazing experience, and I had coordinated the logistics of the trip with military precision. The plan was to leave the base when we were done, drive 74.1 miles to the Raleigh-Durham International Airport, return our rental car, grab lunch, and get to the gate with 90 minutes to spare. After running several scenarios and checking on-time flight histories, I was confident I could make it home that night for the big game. Ellen picked up a field hockey stick for the first time the summer before high school. With some encouragement from a coach she met at the open house for incoming freshmen, and some grueling lessons in 100-degree weather during the summer, she made the team her freshman year. Sadly, when it comes to land sports, Steve and I have 0 genetic gifts to pass down to our kids. We're swimmers, and Steve is a water polo player, but we've got no turf speed. Ellen loved her coaches and her teammates. She worked hard, never missed games or practices, spent hours practicing her stick skills in our yard, and played with heart all 4 years of high school. Suzanne and I were scheduled to land back in Houston 2 hours before the big game, which gave me just enough time to change clothes, load 20 surprise fatheads in my car, and get to the field for senior night. Fatheads are photos of players' faces blown up to like 3 feet tall and 2 feet wide on sticks, and we hold them up in the stands. This was the final field hockey game of Ellen's high school career, and during the halftime ceremony, parents give their senior daughters flowers and escort them across the field. Everything was going according to plan, and I could barely contain my excitement when I got a text from Ellen. "I can't wait to see you tonight. I can't believe it's senior night. OMG, how did time go so fast?" We were lining up to board when I texted back, "I'm so proud of you. I'll be home in a couple of hours. Go Tigers." There had been no movement in the boarding line when the gate agent made an announcement that our flight was delayed 10 minutes due to mechanical difficulties. No sweat, I built in 60 minutes of delays. If we hit 90 minutes of delays, I initiate plan B. I go straight to the game, and my friend Cookie brings up the fatheads. 20 minutes later, I see the pilot talking to the gate agents, and I grab Suzanne by the arm. It startles her and she whispers, "What's wrong? What's going on? Are you okay?" I'm trying to not make a scene, so I whisper back, "They're going to cancel our flight. Get on your laptop right now and book the next flight." Here's one of the many great things about Suzanne. She can get shit done like no one's business. Street fight? You want her on your side. No questions asked, she starts working on flights. But the only way out of North Carolina is to fly to Atlanta, change airlines, and land in Houston at 10 p.m. After she books it, she looks at me and says, "Why do you think they're canceling the flight?" Before I can even answer her question, the gate agent announces that the flight is canceled for mechanical reasons, and there's an immediate stampede to the desk. Suzanne and I find a free space to sit down, and we call back to our office in Houston. Within minutes, three people are working on getting us home in time for the game. After 45 minutes, Suzanne looked at me and said, "I'm so sorry, Brene. There's no way to get home in time for the game." I looked at her, but if we drive, she put her hand on my forearm. "We've tried everything. I'm sorry." I said the one thing I tend to say and repeat when I'm desperately overwhelmed. "I don't understand. I don't understand." Suzanne looked me right in the eyes. "We're not getting home before 10 tonight." I started sobbing. I mean, crying to the point that people were staring. It was a profound experience of empathy for me, because Suzanne didn't care that I was losing it in public. And more important, she didn't try to make the situation better. She just said, "This sucks. This is such bullshit. I'd walk back to Houston with you if it helped." "I don't understand," I said, again, trailing off. "I know what a big deal this is for you. This just sucks. My heart is breaking too." "But this is a big deal," I explained, as if she hadn't just confirmed that in every possible way. Suzanne looked at me and said, "Hell yeah, it's a big deal. It's a super big deal. You did everything you could to be there. It's an important night." So often when someone is in pain, we're afraid to say, "Yeah, this hurts. Yes, this is a big deal. Yes, this sucks." We think our job is to make things better, so we minimize the pain. But Suzanne did not minimize my pain. She had the courage to reflect back to me the truth of how I was feeling, which was that I was destroyed that I couldn't be there for this big night for my daughter. She chose practicing empathy with me over her own comfort. "I really do feel heartbroken." She had nailed what I was feeling when she said her heart was breaking too. Looking back, I see that it was the big game and the special ceremony, but it was also the fact that Ellen was months away from leaving home for college, and this was the first of many formal goodbyes to high school. It was layers of grief. I told Suzanne, "I know in the big scheme of things, it's not a big deal. When I see people crying at airports, I always think about what they might be going through, and I try to smile that, like, 'I see you and I'm so sorry' smile. This is not a funeral or an accident or something really bad. I don't know what's happening to me right now." Suzanne wouldn't have any of the comparative suffering. She wasn't going to minimize my hurt, and she wasn't going to watch me rank order my misery. "No, it's not any of those things, Brene, but this is a big deal. It hurts." I've learned a lot from this research about the danger of comparative suffering and the race to misery. If we believe empathy is finite, like pizza, and practicing empathy with someone leaves fewer slices for others, then perhaps comparing levels of suffering would be necessary. Luckily, empathy is infinite and renewable. The more you give, the more we all have. That means all pain can be met with empathy. There's no reason to rank and ration. This experience with Suzanne was empathy in practice. In those bad moments, it's not our job to make things better. It's just not. Our job is to connect. It's to take the perspective of someone else. Empathy is not connecting to an experience. It's connecting to the emotions that underpin an experience. People often ask me how they can show empathy for someone who is going through something they've never experienced. Again, empathy is connecting to the feeling under the experience, not the experience itself. If you've ever felt grief, disappointment, shame, fear, loneliness, or anger, you're qualified. Now you just need the courage to practice and build your empathy skills. Back at that airport, I was right on the verge of causing a scene with my crying, so I found a hiding spot at the Life is Good airport shop. I know, the irony. If you're the woman who was working there that day, thank you for seeing me and asking me if I was okay. But most of all, I'm so grateful that you let me sit on the floor and hide for 30 minutes. Your kindness mattered. From behind the round rack of colorful t-shirts, I texted Ellen to let her know that I was going to miss the game. I considered calling but chose to text because I didn't want to lose it with her over the phone before the game. Of course, her text back was the stuff that love is made of. I'm sorry about your flight. TBH, I know you're freaking out. But this is one night, and you've come to 100 games and practiced with me and made me go to camps when I didn't want to go and hosted parties and took my entire team to Galveston. That's what counts. Love you so much, I'll tell Dad to take lots of pictures. Steve, on the other hand, got the phone call from under the t-shirt rack. He just listened. When I swore that I was going to quit my job and never get on another flight, he said, I don't blame you. You work so hard on those giant heads and the flowers. You've been such a big support for Ellen. I'm just so sorry this is happening. And thank God again for Suzanne. Several times on the flights home, I'd look at my watch and burst into tears. She would just squeeze my hand and say, I know. Around 8:30 that night, I looked at her and said, the game's over. She looked at me and said, did we get any pictures yet? She said, we. She didn't say, that was hard, but thank God it's over. She asked if we had any pictures yet. She was still in it because I was still in it. It was so hard, but I never felt alone. Empathy is a choice, and it's a vulnerable choice, because if I were to choose to connect with you through empathy, I would have to connect with something in myself that knows that feeling. In the face of a difficult conversation, when we see that someone's hurt or in pain, it's our instinct as human beings to try to make things better. We want to fix. We want to give advice. But empathy isn't about fixing. It's the brave choice to be with someone in their darkness, not to race to turn on the light so we feel better. If I share something with you that's difficult for me, I'd rather you say, I don't even know what to say right now. I'm just so glad you told me. Because in truth, a response can rarely make something better. Connection is what heals. If struggle is being down in a hole, empathy is not jumping into the hole with someone who is struggling and taking on their emotions or owning their struggle as yours to fix. If their issues become yours, now you just have two people stuck in a hole. Not helpful. Boundaries are important here. We have to know where we end and others begin if we really want to show up with empathy. Teresa Wiseman, a nursing scholar in the UK, studied empathy across every profession that requires deep connection and relationship, and she identified four attributes of empathy. These attributes fully aligned with what emerged from my data, but they did not address the idea of paying attention to the degree that it emerged in my work. To solve for that, I added a fifth attribute from Kristen Neff's research. Dr. Neff is a self-compassion researcher at the University of Texas at Austin. We'll look at more of her work in a bit. While each of these components of empathy is rich for study, you'll find hundreds of books in any research library on every one of the five, we're going to explore how these elements come together to create empathy, the rocket fuel for building trust and increasing connection. Empathy skill number one, to see the world as others see it, or perspective taking. We see the world through a set of unique lenses that bring together who we are, where we come from, and our vast experiences. Our lenses certainly include factors like age, race, ethnicity, ability, and spiritual beliefs. But we also have other lenses that shape how we see the world, including our knowledge, insights, and experience. Our take on the world is completely unique because our point of view is a product of our history and experiences. This is why 10 people can witness the same incident and have 10 different perspectives on what happened, how it happened, and why it happened. Are there any observable, knowable, universal truths? Of course. Math and science have given us many examples. But when it comes to the swirl of human emotion, behavior, language, and cognition, there are many valid perspectives. One of the signature mistakes with empathy is that we believe we can take our lenses off and look through the lenses of someone else. We can't. Our lenses are soldered to who we are. What we can do, however, is honor other people's perspectives as truth, even when they're different from ours. That's a challenge. If you were raised in majority culture, white, straight, male, middle class, Christian, and you were likely taught that your perspective is the correct perspective and everyone else needs to adjust their lens. Or, more accurately, you weren't taught anything about perspective taking, and the default, my truth is the truth, is reinforced by every system and situation you encounter. Children are very receptive to learning perspective taking skills because they're naturally curious about the world and how others operate in it. Those of us who were taught perspective taking skills as children owe our parents a huge debt of gratitude. Those of us who were not introduced to that skill set when we were younger will have to work harder and fight armoring up in order to acquire it as adults. Perspective taking requires becoming the learner, not the knower. Let's say that I'm talking to a colleague on my team who's 25, African American, gay, and grew up in an affluent neighborhood in Chicago. In our conversation, we realize that we have completely different opinions about a new program that we want to develop. As we're debating the issues, he says, "My experiences lead me to believe this approach will fall flat with the people we want to reach." I can't put down my straight, white, middle-aged female lens and just snap on his lens and see what he sees, but I can ask, "Tell me more, what are you thinking?" and respect his truth as a full truth, not just an off version of my truth. This is exactly why every study we see confirms the positive correlation between inclusivity, innovation, and performance. Again, it's only when diverse perspectives are included, respected, and valued that we can start to get a full picture of the world, who we serve, what they need, and how to successfully meet people where they are. I love what Beyoncé said in her first-person essay in the September 2018 issue of Vogue. "If people in powerful positions continue to hire and cast only people who look like them, sound like them, come from the same neighborhood they grew up in, they will never have a greater understanding of experiences different from their own. They will hire the same models, curate the same art, cast the same actors over and over again, and we will all lose. The beauty of social media is it's completely democratic. Everyone has a say. Everyone's voice counts, and everyone has a chance to paint the world from their own perspective." She was photographed for the magazine cover by Tyler Mitchell, making him the first African-American photographer to shoot the cover of Vogue in its 126-year history. As we push on these issues and discover our own blind spots, because we all have them, we need to stay very aware of the armor assembly process here. We can't practice empathy if we need to be knowers. If we can't be learners, we cannot be empathetic. And to be clear and kind, if we need to be knowers, empathy isn't the only loss. Because curiosity is the key to rumbling with vulnerability, knowers struggle with all four of the building blocks of courage. Empathy skill number two, to be non-judgmental. It's not easy to do this when you enjoy judging as much as most of us do. Based on research, there are two ways to predict when we're going to judge. We judge in areas where we're the most susceptible to shame, and we judge people who are doing worse than we're doing in those areas. So if you find yourself feeling incredibly judgmental about appearance and you can't figure out why, that's a clue that it's a hard issue for you. It's important to examine where we feel judgment because it can quickly become a vicious shame cycle. The judgment of others leaves us feeling shame, so we offload the hurt by judging others. I see this happen often in organizations. Shit rolls downhill and ends up in the consumer's lap. I've yet to come across a company that has both a shaming and judgmental culture and wonderful customer service. Staying out of judgment means that we are aware of where we are most vulnerable to our own shame, our own struggle. The good news is that we don't judge in areas where we feel a strong sense of self-worth and grounded confidence. So the more of that we build, the more we let go of judgment. Empathy skill number three, to understand another person's feelings. Empathy skill number four, to communicate your understanding of that person's feelings. I'm combining these two attributes because when we break them down to skills, they're inextricably connected. Understanding emotions in others and communicating our understanding of these emotions requires us to be in touch with our own feelings. Ideally, it also means that we are fluent in the language of feelings, or, at the very least, conversational and somewhat comfortable in the world of emotions. The vast majority of people I've interviewed are not comfortable in the world of emotions and are nowhere close to fluent in the language of feelings. Emotional literacy, in my opinion, is as critical as having language. When we can't name and articulate what's happening to us emotionally, we can't move through it. Imagine going to a doctor with an excruciating pain in your right shoulder, a pain so great that every time you feel it, you're left breathless and doubled over. But when you arrive at the doctor's office, you have duct tape over your mouth and your hands are tied behind your back. The doctor's anxious to help you, but when she asks you what happened, you can only manage to say, through your tape. You're desperate to explain, but you're unable to speak, so you can't name it, you can't articulate it, you can't describe it. The doctor asks you to point to it, but your hands are tied, and all you can do is jump up and down with your eyes darting to the right. You mumble and jump until both you and the doctor are exhausted and give up. This is exactly what happens when we aren't fluent in feelings. It's almost impossible to process emotion when we can't identify, name, and talk about our experiences. And if that's not enough of a reason to dig in and start learning, emotional literacy is also a prerequisite for empathy, shame resilience, and the ability to reset and rise after a fall. For example, how do we get back on our feet after a fall if we can't recognize the subtle but important differences between disappointment and anger, between shame and guilt, between fear and grief? And if we can't recognize these emotions in ourselves, it's almost impossible to do so with others. We're finishing a study right now on emotional literacy, and I'll give you the movie trailer. Cue the music and pretend this is the dramatic announcer voice. In a world of emotional literacy, we would be able to recognize and name between 30 and 40 emotions in ourselves and others. I'm hedging on the number because we're in the final stages of confirming the exact emotions, but it's safe to say that fluency in emotional conversation means being able to name at least 30 of them. The last attribute, communicating our understanding of the emotions, can feel like the biggest risk because we can get it wrong. And not if, but when we are off base, we need the courage to circle back. In fact, as long as we show up with our whole hearts, pay attention, and stay curious, we can course correct. This is why therapists are frequently stereotyped as saying, "What I hear you saying is this." It's a check-in that allows someone to say, "Nope, that's not what I'm saying. I'm not sad. I'm pissed off." For example, in non-therapist-y language, you could say, "I'm sorry about the project assignment. That sucks and must be so frustrated. Do you want to talk about it?" This question tells your colleague that you're willing to go there and rumble openly about what they're feeling. Because you were willing to put emotion on the table, it gives them the opportunity to come back and say, "Well, I don't know about frustrated. I mean, I'm actually really embarrassed and disappointed. I mean, everyone talked about me being the perfect fit for this. I never imagined not getting it. Now I have to explain why I didn't get it, and I don't even understand." This exchange alone builds the connection and alignment that we need to have a meaningful, trust-building, and even healing conversation. Navigating the iceberg. One reason emotion is difficult to identify and name is the iceberg effect. Think about an iceberg for a minute. There's the part that you can see above the water, and then it potentially goes on for miles beneath the surface. Many of the emotions that we experience show up as pissed off or shut down on the surface. Below the surface, there's much more nuance and depth. Shame and grief are two examples of emotions that are hard to fully express, so we turn to anger or silence. This is an easy concept to understand for one reason. The vast majority of us find it easier to be mad than hurt. Not only is it easier to express anger than it is to express pain, our culture is more accepting of anger. So the next time you're shutting down or angry, ask yourself what lies beneath. To review, empathy is first, I take the perspective of another person, meaning I become the listener and the student, not the knower. Second, I stay out of judgment. And third and fourth, I try to understand what emotion they're articulating and communicate my understanding of that emotion. Empathy skill number five, mindfulness. I borrowed the fifth element, mindfulness, from Kristen Neff. Neff describes mindfulness as taking a balanced approach to negative emotions so that feelings are neither suppressed nor exaggerated. We cannot ignore our pain and feel compassion for it at the same time. Mindfulness requires that we not be over-identified with thoughts and feelings so that we're caught up and swept away by negative reactivity. The word mindfulness can get on my nerves sometimes, so I opt for paying attention. Neff's findings on mindfulness, especially the piece on not over-identifying with or exaggerating our feelings, are completely aligned with what we found in our work. Ruminating and getting stuck is as unhelpful as not noticing it at all. In short, I try to practice mindfulness by paying attention to what's happening in these conversations, to the feelings they're bringing up in me, to my body language, and to the body language of the person I'm talking to. Minimizing and exaggerating emotions leads to empathic misses in equal measure. What empathy looks like. Whenever I'm teaching empathy, people want more certainty. Early in my teaching career, a social work student asked if I could develop an empathy decision tree. For example, if they say this, I respond with this. If they take this turn, I turn with them and say this. No such luck. Empathy is about connection, and being connected is the best navigation system. If we make a wrong turn in our attempt to be with someone in their struggle, connection is not only forgiving, it's quick to reroute. The empathy decision tree doesn't work because we're all different. For example, if you're sharing something difficult with someone, do you want that person to make eye contact, look away, reach out and hug you, give you space, respond right away, stay quiet and listen? If you ask 100 people these questions, you'll get 100 different answers. The only solution is to connect and pay attention. After I looked at Suzanne in the airport and said, "I don't understand," and she made it clear that I was going to miss Ellen's game, she pulled back a bit but stayed right there with me. Coming in for a hug would have been a bad idea. I wouldn't have actually punched her or put her in a headlock, but I would have wanted to. She was locked in, engaged, and could read me well enough to know that she should look me straight in the eye, tell me that I wasn't going to make Ellen's game, and then lean back and give me some space. Suzanne and I were connected after spending the day together at Fort Bragg. But this also works if you're practicing empathy with someone you don't know that well. Engage, stay curious, stay connected, let go of the fear of saying the wrong thing, the need to fix it, and the desire to offer the perfect response that cures everything. That's not going to happen. You don't have to do it perfectly. Just do it. I had the great pleasure of working with leaders at the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation a couple of years ago and getting to know Melinda, who is a champion of courage building across the foundation and is doing tremendous work modeling how empathy and vulnerability work together to create a more connected culture. A little history on Melinda. After joining Microsoft in 1987, Melinda distinguished herself as a leader in the development of multimedia products and was later appointed Microsoft's General Manager of Information Products. In 1996, Melinda left Microsoft to focus on her philanthropic work and family. Today, along with Bill, she shapes and approves the foundation's strategies, reviews results, and sets the overall direction of the organization. Together, they meet with grantees and partners to further the foundation's goal of improving equity in the United States and around the world. Melinda has seen firsthand that empowering women and girls can bring transformational improvements in the health and prosperity of families, communities, and societies. Her current work focuses on gender equity as a path to meaningful change. On her experiences with vulnerability, Melinda writes, "I started experimenting with vulnerability, and honestly, I've been shocked at the response. Bill and I meet with all foundation employees several times a year, and these meetings are important opportunities for us to build a connection with our team. Recently, I admitted during one of these sessions that Bill and I keep a list of do's and don'ts for ourselves, basically the things we need to work on to make sure we're setting the right example. So many people came up to me later and said knowing that I'm clear about my need to improve helped them feel okay about the things they could do better. I also started talking a bit more about my children in these meetings. I'd always shied away from the subject just because it felt so personal. But it's turned out to resonate with a lot of employees who are also trying to balance work and home life and who are also living their values every day at the foundation and through their parenting. I feel more connected to the individuals in the collective culture of the foundation because I've taken steps to let myself be vulnerable." Empathy in practice. When we're struggling and in need of connection and empathy, We need to share with someone who embraces us for our strengths and struggles, someone who has earned the right to hear our story. Finding that right someone takes practice, and so does being that right person. When it comes to empathy, it's a matter of the right person at the right time on the right issues. There are 6 known barriers to empathy where the practice can go sideways or you can experience an empathic miss. Everyone knows what that feels like when you share something with someone that is personal and vulnerable, like a struggle, or even something exciting or happy, and you don't feel heard, seen, or understood. It's a sinking feeling where you feel exposed and sometimes right on the edge of shame. The clinical term for that is empathic failure, although I prefer empathic miss, because it's not quite as shaming. Let's look at the 6 big ways we tend to miss so that we can recognize them when we experience them and be better when we have the opportunity to connect with people in struggle. Empathy miss number 1, sympathy versus empathy. Want to know what would have made me feel alone and worse at the airport that day? Sympathy. If Suzanne had said, "I'm so sorry, you poor thing," or "I can't imagine how hard this must be for you," she didn't feel bad for me. She felt pain with me. Empathy is feeling with people. Sympathy is feeling for them. Empathy fuels connection. Sympathy drives disconnection. I always think of empathy as the sacred space where someone's in a deep well and they shout out from the bottom, "It's dark and scary down here. I'm overwhelmed." We peer over the edge and say, "I see you." And then we climb down with the confidence that we can get back out. "I know what it's like down here, and you're not alone." Of course, you don't climb down without your own way out. Jumping into a hole with no way out is enmeshment. Jumping into struggle with someone while maintaining clear lines about what belongs to whom is empathy. Sympathy, on the other hand, is looking over the edge of that hole and saying, "Woo, yeah, that's bad. Looks terrible. So sorry." And you keep walking. There's a fun animated short on the difference between empathy and sympathy that the Royal Society for the Arts developed from a short snippet of a lecture I gave in London on empathy. It's illustrated and animated by the talented Katie Davis. You can watch it at brenebrown.com/videos. The 2 most powerful words when someone's in struggle are "me too." So powerful, in fact, that Tarana Burke started one of the most important movements of our time, the Me Too movement, with these 2 words, backing them up with action. The movement addresses the widespread prevalence of sexual harassment and assault, especially in the workplace, and is a great example of how empathy builds courage and can facilitate deep change. Me Too says, "I may not have had the exact same experience as you, but I know this struggle and you're not alone." Sympathy says, "Wow, that's bad. I feel so sorry for you. I don't know or understand what your experience is like, but I'll grant you that it looks pretty bad and I don't want to know." Again, the difference between empathy and sympathy, feeling with and feeling for. The empathic response, "I get it, I feel with you, and I've been there." The sympathetic response, "I feel sorry for you." If you want to see a shame cyclone turn extra deadly, throw one of these at it. "Aw, you poor thing." It's the equivalent of the Southern saying, "Aw, bless your poor heart." When someone feels sorry for us, it magnifies our feelings of being alone. When someone feels with us, it magnifies our feelings of connection and normalcy. Empathy miss number 2, the gasp and awe. In this scenario, your colleague hears your story and feels shame on your behalf. They might gasp, and then they will likely confirm how horrified you should be. They're appalled. They're upset. There's awkward silence. And then you have to make your colleague feel better. Here's an example. "I finally turned in that report yesterday and I was so excited. I felt so good about it. And then my principal called me and told me the last 2 pages of it were missing. I forgot to attach them." You're hoping your coworker is going to say, "Oh man, I've done that. That just sucks." But instead, this person gasps and says, "Oh God, I would just die." And then you're rushing in to say, "No, it's okay." Suddenly you need to make that person feel better. Empathy miss number 3, the mighty fall. In this scenario, your friend needs to think of you as the pillar of worthiness and authenticity. This person can't help you because they're so let down by your imperfections. They're disappointed. This is the person you confide in and say, whew, my performance evaluation did not go how I thought it was going to go. And it kind of, I don't know. I mean, I'm in a shame storm. I mean, I'm almost numb right now. I cannot believe that my rating was so low this quarter. This person's response is, I just never expected that from you. I mean, when I think of you, I don't think of you as the kind of person who gets that rating. I mean, what happened? Then all of a sudden, you're not experiencing connection in an empathetic way. You're defending yourself to someone because they're disappointed. Huh, hint, this happens frequently in childhood and is a huge driver of perfectionism. Empathy miss number four, the block and tackle. Let's bring that performance review to this scenario, where your friend is so uncomfortable with vulnerability that he or she scolds you. How did you let that happen? What were you thinking? Or the friend looks for someone else to blame. Ah, your boss, we should kick his ass or report him. That's ridiculous. That's a huge empathic miss. I came to you because I'm in struggle about something and you're making it easy on yourself by refusing to sit in discomfort. You're choosing instead to be pissed off at someone else or stand in judgment of me. It's just not helpful. Empathy miss number five, the boots and shovel. This is a coworker who desperately needs to make it better so that they can get out of their own discomfort. This person refuses to acknowledge that you can actually make mistakes or bad choices. This is the person who says, you know, it's really not that bad. I mean, it can't be that bad. You're awesome. You're like totally amazing. He's hustling to make you feel better, not hearing anything you feel and not connecting to any emotion that you're describing. It's pretty disconcerting and honestly, it reeks of bullshit. Empathy miss number six. If you think that's bad. This person confuses connection with the opportunity to one up. You know, an example. That's nothing. Let me tell you about my performance evaluation in 1994, fourth quarter. Here's what gets dicey about comparing and competing. The most important words you can say to someone or that you can hear from someone when you're in struggle are, me too. You're not alone. That's different from, oh yeah, me too? Listen to this. The primary distinction is that the latter response shifts the focus to the other person. This is us. You know, here's the bad news. When it comes to empathy, we all know people who come up short, and we've all been the person who comes up short. Empathy is a skill. And here's the amazing news. With some skill building, we can all learn how to practice empathy. That's a huge gift. There are a couple of questions that we should think about as part of our skill building. Number one, when you think about these six types of empathy misses, are there one or two that really shut you down? Number two, what emotion comes up for you when your sharing meets one of these barriers, and how does that affect your connection with that person? Number three, on the flip side, how do you rate your own empathic skills? Number four, are there one or two responses that you typically use that you need to change? Again, we all have friends and colleagues who do this, and we are all friends and colleagues who do this. This is not about us and them. This is all of us, including me. And I've taught this skill for two decades. I hawkishly watch myself when someone's story stirs up my own perfectionistic fear, especially if I think their situation impacts me. When that happens, I'm very susceptible to this big empathy miss. Sometimes I say, oh my God, how could you let that happen? I'm pretty good at avoiding sympathy because I've studied empathy and sympathy for so long. I don't do a lot of I feel bad for you or I feel sorry for you, just because it's probably the one that I'm most affected by on the receiving end. I get a lot of disappointment, personally, masquerading as empathy. In a lecture, I once said, I just want to punch someone. During the Q&A, someone raised their hand and said, you know, the need to punch someone does not feel very wholehearted to me, and you are my wholehearted icon. I jumped right in. I should not be your wholehearted icon. Wholeheartedness is something I'm striving for, but don't make me your role model. I'm on the journey with you trying to get there, but I don't have it mastered. You know, any assumption of perfectionism in other people is an empathic miss. Empathy is a hard skill to learn because mastery requires practice, and practice means you'll screw it up big time more than once. But that's how practice works. If you're not willing to miss, 3,759 shots from the free throw line, you'll never be consistently good at making those shots. In many of our empathy workshops, we ask the participants to sign a poster that says, "I agree to practice empathy, screw it up, circle back, clean it up, and try again." Make that commitment to yourself, your team, your friends, and your family. You have no idea how much it means to someone when you circle back and say, "Hey, you know what? You shared something hard with me yesterday, and I wish I would have shown up in a different way. I really care about you and what you shared. Can I try again?" That is daring leadership. How to practice self-compassion. What's the trickiest barrier to empathy? Take a look in the mirror. Being kind and extending the hypothesis of generosity to ourselves when we mess up is the first step. Resisting the urge to punish or shame ourselves when we make mistakes is true mastery. Dr. Kristen Neff of the University of Texas at Austin, mentioned earlier in this section, runs the Self-Compassion Research Lab and is the author of Self-Compassion, Stop Beating Yourself Up and Leave Insecurity Behind. She writes about the three elements that make up the practice: self-kindness, humanity, and mindfulness. You'll remember mindfulness is empathy skill number 5, which I tweak slightly to paying attention. While mindfulness has applications for empathy as well as self-compassion, with regard to self-compassion specifically, Kristen Neff writes that it requires that we not take on thoughts and emotions as our own that may not belong to us. Put plainly, don't take responsibility and ownership for the words of other people. Just own your part. So in practice, change, "Oh, she was so irritated with me," to simply, "She was so irritated." Don't fixate, don't ruminate, don't get stuck. Neff's definition of self-kindness is contained and self-explanatory. It's being warm and understanding toward ourselves when we suffer, fail, or feel inadequate, rather than ignoring our pain are flagellating ourselves with self-criticism. In my own life, this translates to one simple mandate: talk to yourself the way you talk to someone you love. Most of us shame, belittle, and criticize ourselves in ways we'd never think of doing to others. I would never look at Ellen or Charlie and say, "God, you're so stupid." Yet I can whisper that to myself in a heartbeat. I'll give you a real example from my life. I recently did an interview with a journalist for a magazine article. I always feel extremely vulnerable during media interviews because I'm not good at filtering, staying on script, and watching everything that I say. The on-the-record scenario is exactly the opposite of the type of interviewing I've done thousands of times for over 20 years, where the goal is to uncover real experiences by connecting, being open, and mutually sharing without any fears or filters. I'm never going to use anything in the research that you ask me not to, and you're never going to be identified unless we talk about it first. You agree, and then you sign off on how I capture your words. Well, in the middle of this 2-hour interview, which is way too long, the interviewer asks a question about juggling multiple priorities, and I respond with, "Ugh, that's so effing hard," but the real word. I immediately say, "Oh God, sorry, scratch that," but it's too late. I was quote unquote on the record. That's fair. I was careless. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm a cusser from a long matriarchal line of cussers. I'm super comfortable with that. I just try to limit it in my writing. I think it has to do with my belief that in conversation, a well-placed cuss word, or three, seems really good. But in writing, it seems more intentional and less organic. And if it's on a t-shirt or something worn in public, I will go Texas Baptist church lady on you. According to Steve, my language is way worse now than when I started my work. And it gets worse with every year of research. People share the toughest, most wrenching moments of their lives with me, and they don't sugarcoat their language, thankfully. Their words are as real, gritty, and rough as their stories. To make matters worse, Steve has nicknamed me the Borg from Star Trek. Just like the fictional drones that copy and replicate other aliens, I have a tendency to pick up the accents and mannerisms of other people that I'm around for any length of time. I interviewed a guy a few months ago who constantly talked about his bosses being, quote, total pricks, end quote. Not a week later, Steve and I were in his truck when someone cut us off, and I pushed my face against the closed window and said, "What a total prick. Don't be such a total prick, dude." Steve, having never heard me use that particular term in 30 years, just shook his head and laughed. Anyway, once I realized that my F-bomb was on the record, the very first thing I said to myself was, "You are such an idiot, Brené. Can't you hold it together for 2 hours?" Again, I would never talk that way to my family members or my colleagues. Instead, I would say something like, "You're exhausted. You're on a crushing book deadline. You're overwhelmed. Give yourself a break. And don't be so hard on yourself. You're human, and a lot of people relate to your messiness." But I beat myself up for 2 days until Steve grabbed me by the shoulders and said those exact words. Self-kindness is self-empathy. And even when I talk to myself like someone I love and it feels weird, it works. I also love Neff's definition of common humanity as uniting us in our discomfort rather than pushing a "it's just me" worldview. Common humanity recognizes, she writes, that suffering and personal inadequacy is part of the shared human experience, something that we all go through rather than being something that happens to me alone. This is one of the foundations of empathy and one of the linchpins of the Me Too movement. The more we practice these conversations of connection, the more we learn that we are all connected in both the good things and the hard things. Remember, empathy is the most powerful connecting and trust-building tool that we have, and it's the antidote to shame. If you put shame in a petri dish and cover it with judgment, silence, and secrecy, you've created the perfect environment for shame to grow until it makes its way into every corner and crevice of your life. If, on the other hand, you put shame in a petri dish and douse it with empathy, shame loses its power and begins to wither. Empathy creates a hostile environment for shame, an environment it can't survive in, because shame needs you to believe that you're alone and it's just you. That's why there's so much power in sayings like, "Oh man, I feel you," or "I know that feeling and it sucks," or "Me too," or "I see you and you're not alone," or just someone saying, "You know what, I've been in a similar place and it's really hard." I think a lot of us experience that. Either we're all normal or we're all weird. Either way, it's not just you. Or just a simple, "God, I understand what that's like." Empathy and shame resilience. Now that we're building some understanding and skills around empathy, let's examine the four elements of shame resilience. When we're in shame and we can share our story with someone who responds with empathy and understanding, shame can't survive. So the first element of shame resilience is recognizing shame and understanding its triggers. The question is, can you physically recognize when you're in the grip of shame? Can you feel your way through it and figure out what messages and expectations triggered that shame? Research participants with the highest levels of shame resilience can recognize the physical symptoms of shame. They know the physiology of it, and that's a huge cue to pay attention. My saying is, when in shame, I don't talk, text, or type because I'm not fit for human consumption until I get back on my emotional feet. When we have understanding and awareness around shame, we're less likely to default to our shame shields, or what Linda Hartling and her fellow researchers at the Stone Center at Wellesley call strategies of disconnection. There are three strategies of disconnection. The first is we move away by withdrawing, hiding, silencing ourselves, and secret keeping. The second is we move toward by seeking to people please and to seek approval. Number three, we move against. We try to gain power over others by being aggressive and by using shame to fight shame. Like all armor, all three of these are appealing forms of self-protection, but they move us away from authenticity and wholeheartedness. The second element of shame resilience is practicing critical awareness. Shame works like the zoom lens on a camera. When we are feeling shame, the camera is zoomed in tight, and all we can see is our flawed self, alone and struggling. We think, "I'm the only one. Something is wrong with me. I am alone." When we zoom out, we start to see a different picture. We see that many people are in the same struggle. Rather than thinking, I'm the only one, we start thinking, oh my God, I can't believe it. You too? I'm normal? I thought it was just me. Once we start to see the big picture, we're better able to reality check our shame triggers and the social expectations that fuel shame.